Well, hello everyone. Thanks again for downloading or Spotifying or listening to this next episode of the podcast. I'm very, very happy today to have a great guest, Robert Suda, who's the Tech VP of Quantum Computing at IBM Research in Yorktown in New York. So, Robert, thanks a lot for sitting down for an hour with me.
Sure, pleased to be here, Simon.
So before we get started, again, simply because of sort of your background and sort of your non-traditional sort of encroachment into quantum computing, so let's have a little bit of a chat about sort of how you got into this, because you've been with IBM for quite a long time now.
Oh yeah, 37 years, and that doesn't even count as being a summer student before that.
Wow.
Well,
Yeah, no.
it's nice to be employed, I would say,
Yeah, exactly. I'm just thinking, I'm only 38, so you got started when I was 1 year old.
Someone said, computing is only like 70 years old, so wow, you've seen half of it. It's like how to make a guy feel old. I mean,
I mean, that must have been really interesting to sort of come up, over nearly 4 decades of research and development from IBM. I mean, you must have seen just about everything.
At this point, I consider myself very fortunate for that. I mean, I even sort of saw the very end of the punch card era. I took a summer class in Brooklyn, New York, one time, and we used punch cards. But that was it. That was the last time. And once we got this will sound strange. Once we got to like real terminals, CRTs, things started to go very quickly, of course, right? And so with what we now think of as like Moore's Law, right? There's been so much advancement, so quickly over the time that I've been involved. It's mind-boggling.
But I mean, you sort of came in, what would have been about early 80s, right? So you would have just gotten in as sort of the computing went from sort of the mainframe servers more so into the sort of consumer electronics and sort of the historic battle between IBM and Apple when the sort of the PC first came in. You were sort of there around that time.
That's right. The IBM PC was introduced in the early 80s. And I think originally it was conceived as largely a business machine, but with the earlier work of Apple, remembering that PC stands for personal computers, it did take off and many other people entered the market. But at the same time, as it is today, right, we have many more types of computers. Your phone would have been considered a supercomputer probably 30 years ago. But then laptops, processors in your automobiles and your thermostats, high-performance computing, mainframes continue to do a great job processing most of the financial transactions in the world and many other things. So there's just more types of computing, right? And it's all advanced, but really the best type of computing for what we want it to do.
Well, so the reason I bring it up is that, a lot of us within the quantum computing field, when the media talks to us or when students talk to us, they always want to sort of analogize. They want to say, well, where are quantum computers? Are we in the 50s or in the 60s or in the 70s? So the fact that you've sort of lived through sort of at least the consumer revolution in personal computers, I suppose I'll get, right to the point early on in the podcast. Where are we?
Well, it's difficult exactly lining us up with the development of classical systems. And part of the problem doing that is we know what the development of classical systems were. We don't have to repeat the same mistakes and go through the same sort of learning, if you will, with that. And there's another point to this, which is I think we have to separate out the terms quantum computing and quantum computers, right? In this way. If I talk about classical computing, and again, these are your phones, your laptops, for us, the IBM power systems, mainframes, all these sorts of things. Classical computing involves classical computers with an architecture that goes back to the 40s. Quantum computing does not only involve quantum computers. That is, the thing we call quantum computing extends classical computing by allowing us also to use quantum computers for certain types of operations, right? So so they're compatible, they work together. Quantum computers are not meant at this stage in the evolution of our species to completely replace classical computers. Mm-hmm. I do not need a phone quantum computer interface. Classical computers do just fine for that, right? Yeah. So I think one of the things for this year, frankly, is we have to do a better job of separating the terms out.
So, I mean, how did you get involved with this? I mean, and maybe just explain also to the audience what your actual role is at IBM. Because, I mean, you do have a PhD in mathematics, but mm-hmm. certainly, you know, you're not known from coming through from the research side of quantum computing.
That's correct. I am by no means a quantum computer researcher. Jay Gambetta leads the IBM quantum program at research. He is an IBM vice president as well as an IBM fellow. So he's one of our top scientists as well as an executive. Well, the way I got into this was after doing many things at IBM, including really starting my career in research for 15 years, I went off on the business side, but came back in 2012 to lead the math department. And mathematical sciences at IBM goes way back to the late 1950s. We've done many things, contributed to a lot of theory, contributed to a lot of products. But when I came back, what we looked at as mathematical science is much of that you would consider AI today. So a lot of it was machine learning, right? Machine learning was part of this thing that we called analytics. And then it was called data science briefly, and then AI swept over and took over everything, really. So in that role, I had a very large remit, if you will, to look at things that involved mathematics that related to what IBM might be interested in. Mm-hmm. We had been working on quantum computing, we IBM Research, for many years. In fact, the first mention of the term quantum information theory was in February of 1970 by IBM fellow Charlie Bennett. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is almost 50 years, right? We have been looking at quantum something regarding information theory and eventually computing. But for me, I became aware of what we were doing on the hardware side and the very nascent let me say computer science side, more around the way of making it available to people. And then I started looking at what it was. And obviously, there's an awful lot of mathematics to quantum computing. Clearly, there's physics, too. So, you know, being intellectually curious, I guess you'd say, I started learning more about this. I started a group within the math department to look at quantum algorithms and quantum software. We eventually kind of reorganized ourselves and we, with Jay Gambetta, put our arms completely around quantum computing research, right? And so we moved a group of my people to quantum. As I mentioned before, a lot of the applied math was AI, so they went to AI. And I decided I wanted to do this whole time because it's very rare that you really have the chance to get in the very early stages of a new industry.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you can pop in, you can evolve what people have already done. So for me, technologically, it was very interesting. Intellectually, it was very interesting. But there was a new business to be built as well. Right. And as I mentioned before, we didn't have to repeat the way we used to do it. So what does that mean? What does it mean to build an ecosystem of people who do quantum computing, who use quantum computers? And I always like explaining things, should we say. So I was very attracted to the role. And I said to the heads of research, I want to do this full time. And they let me do it. So away we went.
So it was basically, so you and Jay sort of got together at the time and I mean, certainly a lot of all of us in the field are aware of IBM's long history through Charlie and John Smolin and Sergey and all the guys who did a lot of great theory work. But then, yeah, there really was this inflection point maybe 5 or 6 years ago where it sort of turned from this sort of small group within IBM of very, very good researchers and then sort of exploded, especially on the experimental side. So this was you and Jay around that time.
Well, this was, I came in a little bit later from its start. I was at the beginning, I was involved a little bit more at the peripherally with these. It was discussed a lot within the leadership of research, and so I knew more about it. I think it really goes back to an agreement around 2015. Where IBM Systems, and these are the people who make the power computers, the Z systems, the mainframes, so forth, storage, and research decided to get together and kick off this thing called quantum computers and really to do it together, right? So Systems is a business. It is longstanding. They know how to make very reliable computers. They have thousands of engineers around the world to do this. And research had the scientists. So, you know, there have been many relationships, good relationships, between research and systems through the years. Some of them might have been research develops the next generation of some chip, which then systems puts it into a machine and again, you know, productizes and things like this. But this was a cooperative effort very early on. And in May of 2016, I mean, that's one of the most important data points for us, which was we put a 5-qubit quantum computer on the cloud. We probably would have said on the web at that point.
Yeah.
But it was the first bona fide, I believe, quantum computer that was up for anybody to register and use. And since then, we've registered over 200,000 users. So seems to have been a good idea.
Yeah, well, it certainly kicked off. But when you guys were sort of putting it all together, as you said, sort of the 2015-ish period, I mean, certainly people knew about quantum computing, but it certainly didn't reach the level of sort of widespread knowledge that it is now. I mean, there wasn't huge numbers of corporates that were getting deeply, deeply involved in this, and especially from the experimental side, which costs so much money. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what was the motivating factor? What made everyone decide that, look, it's really now time that this stuff has, you know, we've seen the proof of principles enough in the physics labs. Now we're going to dump basically a crap ton of money on this and try to push it out as a commercial enterprise.
Well, so actually getting the machine up and running, this was, as I mentioned, Jay Gambetta. It was Jerry Chow. It was Ismail Ferro. You know, basically a very small group of people who realized that the machines we had in our lab were stable enough to put on the cloud. I mean, it would have been pointless to put up something that just crashed all the time, right?
And had
no availability. So it was that realization and then a challenge to themselves, driven by Dario Gil, who's now the head of research, to say, let's do it. You know, let's just make this work, figure out what happens. And it takes people like that who are willing to push it. And sometimes in research, you can be a little bit too conservative, right? You can always say, well, in another 6 months, it'll get ready. It's good to have forcing functions, right? I guess that's one way of saying it.
Sure, sure.
You know, to that point, right now we have 15 quantum computers that are available on the cloud of various sizes. And, you know, each size, there's a reason for having a 5, a 14, a 20, a 1. 56. There's a new 28. So totally confounds people who think we're just adding more qubits all the time.
But do you try and keep the machine? You know, you don't sort of take them offline. As you put them online, you just sort of add to the network.
Yeah, some of the ones we've replaced. The fives are new as of October. So the original, just to think of the qubit layout, the original 5-qubit layout, which we called Yorktown, looked a little bit like a bow tie. So there were 5 qubits, 2 on each side, 1 in the middle, mm-hmm. and then physical connections for 2-qubit operations like C-knots. The current five looks more like a T. For various reasons, right? I mean, we could talk a lot about, you know, how you create the architecture, how you lay out your qubits and the connectivity among them. So we upgrade them from time to time, but there is a tremendous amount of use for fives. I mean, you know, to learn quantum computing, right? To learn about noise, the effect of noise on algorithms, you can do an awful lot with a five-qubit machine. But it's important that it's actual hardware and not just a simulator. Now, on the other end, you know, the premier partners within the IBM Q network, they want that 53, right? Five is very nice, thank you, but they want that 53.
Yeah, they want to be able to push this as far as they can get, you know, within the constraints of the error rates in your systems, and certainly to develop a whole bunch of new software, which a lot of your project partners are, aren't they? I mean, yes, you don't have any hardware partners within, or at least no other quantum computing developers within IBM Q.
I'm trying to think within the Q network. Most of them, let me start kind of at a basic level. Certainly, we source various parts of our machines from people, so they are partners as part of our supply chain. Otherwise, I would say that we have cooperative research agreements with various universities that are hardware related right now, but there isn't a pure like 50-50 hardware partnership.
Because aren't you working with Alpine?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Put Ion Traps on the cloud?
Yeah, we did announce that we would put one of the Alpine computers up on the cloud. That is available. So yes, I guess I would consider that partnership. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So at the very least, is that up and running yet? I haven't checked actually.
Yes. Yeah, it's been up.
Okay. So through the IBM Q network, you can get access to superconducting qubits and ion traps.
That's right. Through, I'm going to use the brand here, but just to speak generally, through the IBM cloud. All right. And the reason why I mention this is because there have been two notable other industry players who have clouds, who have made a lot about putting quantum computers eventually on their clouds. We often, it seems, don't mention our cloud enough. Right. This idea of quantum computers on the cloud, as I just said, is it's coming up on being 4 years old. Right. And so certainly, yes, yeah, you know, more people are going to enter the market. There's no question about that. But the idea of quantum computers on the cloud is far from new. Right. We wish them luck in their various ways, but the concept's not new.
No, of course. I mean, certainly the IBM Q system was probably the system that was most stable and has persisted and certainly generated the most amount of interest. But certainly, you know, as you well know, people had been predicting for a while that the cloud-based services were the obvious avenue for quantum, considering that you can't really have a dill fridge or a vacuum system sitting in the room next door to you without too much effort.
Well, yeah, and what I usually say is, quantum computing is advancing very quickly. And so we and others are starting to use this measurement of quantum volume to be useful within an analog to Moore's law, right? So sometimes people call this Gambetta's law. Jay's getting a lot of attention today. But, you know, it's nice to have a single metric which says, all right, if we're going to boil it all down to one number, this gives you a sense of, are we better than we were last year? And what do we hope to get to in the future? And that's this idea of quantum volume. And so that is, again, from a single metric perspective, what is driving us, right? So to constantly increase this quantum volume, we said we want to double it every year. We just announced that we had doubled it again to what's called a quantum volume of 32. Mm-hmm. We were able to do that in 10 months. The last time we boosted it was last March. So what that means, though, to your accessing something on the cloud versus buying one is if the power of your quantum computer is doubling every year, if you just bought one, right, it's going to be relatively pretty slow and not so powerful within a year, 2 years, 3 years, right? 3 years, it's going to have one, what you own is going to have 1/8 the quantum volume of what you should have then. So use it on the cloud. It seems to be the smarter investment.
Well, I mean, to be sure that I can remember when I was a teenager with the real sort of peak of clock speeds sort of really doubling every, 12 to 18 months. And yeah, I remember it then where it was sort of, yeah, you just put one of your machines together and already we're up to a Pentium 3 or a Pentium 4 and the clock speed had doubled to a gigahertz or something like that. But I suppose it's not quite the same level of investment as building a quantum computer or buying a quantum computer.
Not the level of investment, but I also remember the kind of sense of, oh, damn, I thought this was the
Yeah. So the
fastest
other
machine.
reason we got you on to talk today was you've got a new book out called Dancing with Qubits, How Quantum Computing Works and How It Can Change the World. It seems like it's quite a tome. And clocks in at a good 500 pages. So you must have spent quite a bit of time putting this thing together.
Well, I predicted it would be 300 pages, and then I was having so much fun, I just kept going. I
That's
think
writing. Oh, I'm not a big fan of it personally.
it's well, this is the reason why, and I've answered questions on places like LinkedIn about the length. Don't think of it about the length, but think about the pacing of how the material is presented. Right. So I'm, as you mentioned, I have a PhD from Princeton in theoretical math. I do know how to write very dense, mathematically oriented text if I really wanted to. Right. And had I been wanting to write a book that was strictly, let me say, researcher oriented, well, one, there would be questions to why I was writing that book, but it could have been much terser, but my audience were people who maybe either didn't have quite as much math or maybe had done some math. For example, they might have been some sort of science major in college and in university, and then went on to do other things, right? So at some point they'd seen some math. They might have done okay with it, but life happens. And it can be very scary if you want to learn about quantum computing and someone throws a paper at you from archive or something else. It's like, where do you even begin? So I set out to really systematically start from the basics to get people through enough material. So this would include circuits, some of the standard algorithms, some of the things toward the end of the book are admittedly difficult. But when you get through this, I hope that then you can go off and read some of the papers, or then you can go off and really work through, something like Mike and Ike, Nielsen and Chung, right? Quantum Computation and Quantum Information. Excellent book, probably the book at the center of the quantum computing universe, and will be for a long time. Not always an easy book, right?
So how would you, sorry, how would you compare sort of the level of your book compared to something like Mike and Ike?
That's much harder. That is much harder. That is probably you're going to be a physics major for that, and probably at a pretty good school. I would say. I
And also keep
originally
in mind that Mike and Ike's, well, 20 years old now.
that's true. And even with what I wrote, you have to be very conscious of what I call shelf life. And there I was thinking about the ideas of, as we discussed a little bit earlier, things are changing very rapidly in quantum computing. What can I say now that in 1 year isn't going to sound quaint and old, right? Now, yeah, there's always the possibility for updates or other additions or things like that. But I was hoping to have it be able to sit for a while. So I would, I mentioned before kind of the spectrum of high level, easy to understand, but not always correct, and the very intense, extremely correct, very scientific. And so, first of all, correctness is I aim to be completely correct. If there are errors, well, those should be corrected, right? So that's not the question. I decided early on, look, you're going to have to learn some math, but frankly, I start you off with things like the natural numbers and the integers, you know, because I've got to get people to understand complex numbers. And I wanted them to have a feel for them and not just have them thrown at. Here are some new numbers and they operate this way. Get over it, right? That's not what I wanted to do. So I wanted people to say, okay, well, this part seems reasonable, right? Okay. Having complex numbers makes sense. Okay. And now we move on from there. And, when you're dealing with quantum computing, look, you're going to get into high dimensions very, very quickly. What does that even mean? What's a dimension? Right? A lot of people don't know that. So what that means is really linear algebra. And so reminding people of a little bit of geometry, right, that they might have seen, and then taking that and generalizing a little bit at a nice pace into linear algebra, and then doing a little probability, just enough probability to finish off the foundation and then start talking about quantum computing, right? So through the first half of the book, I wanted people to feel comfortable with the math. And then we would get serious about quantum.
So a lot of these books end up getting into sort of the programming of quantum computing. So they're sort of targeted towards sort of software engineers, coders, stuff like that, people that, you know, we want to drag in from sort of the classical computing community to get involved with quantum. As far as I can tell, your book doesn't, well, let's say it doesn't dwell on that kind of stuff very much. It really is sort of a
That's
softer
right.
version of Nielsen and Chuang.
There were several other books out already that went into programming. In particular, for us, for IBM, we developed and started the original open source community around Qiskit. But Qiskit's evolving very rapidly too. At IBM, working with the Qiskit community, have developed an open source textbook for Qiskit coding. So that is effort that is being done by my colleagues, right? I haven't contributed because I've been focusing on this other thing. And the idea is that many people will contribute to that from a coding perspective, and they will be able to keep it up to date as Qiskit goes through its various versions. So forth. I have left the door open, at least in my mind, a little bit. I spoke before about, as things stabilize. So there's certainly some things in the future, let's say 2 years from now, that at the risk of making the book slightly longer, there are probably a few technologies I might go a little bit more deeply into. And there's also let's put it this way. I own the domain name Coding with Qubits, as well as Dancing with Qubits. So, a couple of years from now, I think, again, once things are a little bit more settled, maybe there will be room for a companion text if I don't just otherwise contribute to what IBM's already doing.
Right. So at the moment, this sort of Qiskit related book is part of sort of the online documentation at the moment, or is this going to come out as a separate thing or a separate sort of self-contained book?
It's available online. It's an online book.
Ah, okay.
It uses Jupyter Notebooks. You can access the IBM computers and use Qiskit through the IBM Q experience or the IBM Quantum experience. And so you can simply bring that up and use the online textbook directly. There's nothing to download. You can just use it. There. It does focus much more on the coding side of Qiskit. Of course, there are quantum concepts that are introduced, but it's just available there. I have done some things in this book. The print book is black and white. There is a PDF-like ebook available from the publisher Pact Publishing, and fingers crossed, if all goes well, the Kindle version should be out within a couple of weeks. That was a task unto itself to make a reflowable version of the book, but for what it's worth, the colors are the same for circuits and things as our quiz kit. So at least as people look through the circuits in the book, I hope it makes it a little bit easier for people to then actually use QuizKit, use the IBM computers online.
Mm-hmm. And how's the reception been so far?
It's been good. It's not a New York Times bestseller list type of book, but what I've liked in the reviews that I've seen, and then they've been good, is that people seem to recognize the audience, which, right? Mm-hmm. They'll say things like, "Ah, this is the book for me," right? And so there will be many books on quantum computing, but I want this to go for that particular set of the audience who really feels that they want to get into it at a proper pace, and learn it without being scared really by the material. And so the reviews so far have indicated that, so I'm pleased.
Do you feel that people still get intimidated by quantum, or it's just gotten, with all of the stuff that's going on at IBM, Microsoft, Google, this stuff's in everyone's face so much now. At least my personal experience is that people seem to be a little less intimidated by the whole concept of it than they were 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, I think you have to decide first who that group of people is who either is not intimidated or might be intimidated, or how large that group is. Quantum computing 5 years ago was a very small community, mm-hmm. right? Most of them were university researchers, right? Yet now, I mentioned before the number that we've had over 200,000 people register to use the IBM computers on the cloud. So the potential audience is much larger and I think different. Yes, we will continue to attract and should attract the hardcore physicists, increasingly computer scientists, but there are a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of coders, let's put it this way. How many software engineers out there, right? How many software engineers out there who will need to learn more about quantum computing? I think it's the potential size of the audience is huge, right? Self-select among these books. Anyway.
No, it was the next question I was going to ask you, because certainly this sort of idea of trying to drag in classical people or sort of traditional software developers to start looking at finding programs or finding applications for at least near-term quantum computers has certainly been a big goal of IBM and basically everyone who's been trying to get into mm-hmm. the space. And the idea of, let's put it onto the cloud, let's try and build a development framework around quantum computing that's a little more familiar for people who don't come from the quantum computing side, to sort of entice them to come in and start working. Because, as I've said many times on this podcast, physicists are poor algorithm developers, and we really shouldn't be doing it. But looking at what's happened, especially with Qiskit in the past 3 or 4 years, ever since the first quantum computers on your system were launched, I mean, how much are you seeing engagement? How much are you seeing people coming in and sort of fulfilling that goal that many of us thought might happen if you did this? I mean, or are they thinking of it more of sort of just a little bit of a trinket that they can play with on the weekend before they get back to their real job?
We are seeing it. We are involved with things like the Qiskit camps. That have been held in Tokyo, in Africa, in New York. There's another one coming up soon. There's one in Switzerland. We do a lot of hackathons around the world. People are getting into it, right? they're very curious, and in fact, this is one thing which we haven't quite talked about, which is, there are lots of technologies in the world. Why are people interested in quantum, of all things? Right? What's the attraction? Because there definitely is something. We have for about 3 years now been bringing these models of 50-qubit machines around to different events around the world. And we have had conservatively estimated over 100,000 selfies taken with these things, right? They're beautiful. They look like upside-down chandeliers. They're golden.
100,000. So how many of them do you have?
We have three of them,
Oh,
but
wow.
we've been at CES 3 years in a row, right? That alone accounts for tens of thousands. We have been at many, many events around the world. No, it's true. I mean, that, as I said, that's a conservative number. If you watch it, as people, their eyes lock on it from across the room and they start moving toward it.
It looks very retro. I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, someone called it a steampunk chandelier. I think that was Wired that called it. But there is something about quantum, and maybe it's because of science fiction, right? There was an American TV show probably about 20 years ago now called Quantum Leap. The movie Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp both talk about the quantum realm, whatever that is. They even do a kind of a funny riff on sticking the word quantum in front of everything. So whatever the heck it is, a lot of people have been exposed to this word quantum in front of something else. So there is a natural curiosity, like, oh, you mean it's real? It's not just, in comic books and things like that. So we have been very lucky, therefore, regarding awareness, right? People ask us to tell them more. Right. On the business side, if this was a marketing podcast, we would talk about how can you get more people interested in what you're doing? How can you get to, initially have them learn about what you're offering? Whereas with quantum, very, very frequently they come to us. So that is good. And that then kind of maps back to the book, which is, there's many different types of people who want to get into this with different sorts of backgrounds. They're not all physicists, they're not all computer scientists. What I tried to do, again, getting back to the length, was to ease them into this, in a comfortable way. Now again, if you want to read Mike and Ike, great book. Go for it if that's your level. And there are other books as well. This one is, just I try to do it in a conversational way as well. I mean, that's meant by comfortable, right? I'm not trying to do a straight math text. I'm trying to make you feel good as you go along. Every once in a while, I say, "See, that's why that works." Perhaps you always wondered, right?
But I mean, obviously, IBM wants to see, apps that are potentially lucrative to outside businesses that are at least on the scale of what you guys hope to develop from a hardware perspective over the next 5 years. I mean, are we seeing this? Has there been anything interesting that's been coming out of sort of the collaborations that IBM Q has sort of spawned? Or are we still sort of, look, it's quantum chemistry, it's factoring, it's stuff that's going to require error correction, that stuff that's a million qubits down the road?
So, yeah, so this is a very, well, again, going back to kind of a business angle, business person might say, well, what is it good for and when can I use it and when will it help me do better than my competition? And based as all part of that is, and how can I make money and more money than other people? That, it turns out, with quantum is difficult right now because there is no quantum computer on the world, in the world realm, that does things for practical applications better than what a classical computer can do right now. It's just not the case. And it will be a few years. And we term that quantum advantage, Right. When there are various applications, and you mentioned a few of them, typically they'll be in chemistry, which is a very broad area, including material science. Pharmacology is way off in the future, financial services, so forth, various things like this. So one way of looking at it is looking at what papers are being produced and by whom and what sort of collaboration. We started in late 2017, the IBM Q Network. And this, we had various goals. So you mentioned, what makes people do this? IBM is a business. Are we getting people involved? Which all goes to, will this be a viable business? We invest a lot in this, and will there be something at the other end? But we would term this as, well, does it really provide value to our clients so that improves their business and therefore we benefit as well? So we started the Q Network with really two types of members. One were premier members like JP Morgan Chase, so financial services, long-term research. It's very worth it to financial services companies to look into new technologies, because even if it's going to take 4 or 5 years, if it does pay off, it will pay off quickly and they'll do well and all these types of things. Chemistry was another area, so forth, things like that. The other type of member at the time were hubs. And so we now have 13 hubs. The first one was Keio University near Tokyo, but North Carolina State, University of Montpellier. I'm immediately blanking on this, Oxford, Melbourne, so forth. We ourselves in IBM Research could not work with everybody who wanted to figure out how to get advantage in these use cases.
Right.
So we had to somehow federate out. And so the idea is with a hub like Keio University is they have expertise in quantum research, but as a university, they also work with local corporations. So their hub works with, for example, Mitsubishi Chemical, MUFG, and so forth. There was a recent paper with Mitsubishi Chemical and Keio and us about lithium batteries, right? So that's a proof point, right? There is a lot of other background work that is going on with these people. Now, we also have other types of members. So one large group is startups. These are people who want access to quantum computers because eventually many of them feel that they will provide software and solutions for these industry use cases. And then we have many universities as well, right? And so that's really at both levels. How can we work together to allow them to do better research? But also, how can they teach quantum? Going back to the ecosystem again, how can they be training more people who will somehow fit into this world of quantum computing? In that sense of education, 3 years ago, my view on education would have been, we need a lot more semester long or 2 semester long courses on quantum computing. And those are nice. But yeah, I'll give you one example. When I took linear algebra many years ago, we did this matrix factorization. And I was a theoretical mathematician. I was a freshman at the time, but it was a theoretical math class. And so, you never say, well, what is it good for? You just say, oh, that's interesting. Let's go on. Eventually, it'll be part of something else. And thinking back at some point, I realized it was factorization of unitary matrices, right? Which physicists rather cared about, let's put it that way. I never much knew why, right? Until I realized a little bit before writing the book that that's what that was for. So this means that when you're teaching quantum computing, there's a lot to plug into many other courses. You don't need a whole class. So supplement that linear algebra class, supplement that computer architecture class, supplement that crypto class, right? So We work with people in universities in lots of different ways to make quantum computing in its various parts, components of their different, you know, parts of the curriculum.
So, I mean, in the context of, I mean, we've heard a lot about this from the standpoint of, you know, there's all these startups, there's all these corporations, they want quantum people, blah, blah, blah. I mean, certainly here in Sydney, we've launched the Sydney Quantum Academy. This is all built around training and education and producing people for the workforce. I mean, what's your feeling at IBM? I mean, are you seeing the same thing, that you want to hire 50 or 60 new people, but you can't because they don't exist?
So right now, many of the quantum people we hire are researchers, right? So these are typically physics PhDs, or they might be algorithms people, right? Could be computer scientists. We hire people in what we call the IBM QStart program. Many of these are people with PhDs in a variety of fields who work with a lot of our clients and partners in the Q network, right? So these are the people who have, you know, the clients have identified use cases, or we have worked with them. We have people who aren't necessarily researchers, but have advanced knowledge of quantum computing, but also want to work closely with clients. We do have people who I would call quantum software engineers. And I think there will be a greater need for them. I think the way the stack is developing, I think we've now had some experience at the uppermost portion of the stack. So what that would be is someone saying, look, I know there's a quantum computer under there. I just want to call a function to compute something. Use your quantum computer if you must, but I'm going to call it and you give me the answer, right? Person who doesn't necessarily care too much about quantum, but who's going to be developing those high-level user libraries? These are our quantum software engineers, right? So it's above, somewhat above, maybe including the circuit algorithm people. I think that group is set for to get much bigger, and then a little bit later, how people start to incorporate quantum into the types of things they're doing. If you're doing high performance computing right now, you know, what, you know, so someone who's listening to this, if you are doing high performance computing, where will quantum play for you? Mm-hmm. Where do you look? Who will you hire to help you do that? Doesn't necessarily have to be a physicist. Who will you hire in 4 or 5 years? Are they in school now? What should they be learning in order to help you out, right? So these are the types of things we're trying to answer, and what and how we're trying to train people.
So what about, I mean, that's obviously the work with sort of the clients and the people who would want to build software or use quantum computers. What about people in the labs? People are actually engineering your quantum computers.
In terms of our hiring them, or what do you mean?
Well,
about
in terms of sort of talent flow, I mean, you know, I do a lot of work with the Japanese superconducting groups, and quite frankly, they're annoyed at you guys because they can't hire postdocs, because whether it's IBM, whether it's Google, you know, the other players doing superconducting, at the moment, they're just out competing them because, quite frankly, you guys pay more.
Well, I don't think I should particularly apologize for that. We have a very active program. We have extraordinary scientists. We have many people who want to work for us, right? So, you know, all that. But, you know, the mix will continue to evolve, right?
Well, I suppose the reason why I asked is that you mentioned about sort of dedicated training programs before, and maybe, you know, there are other ways of doing it, you know, having, you know, parts of a course that are sort of maybe 3 or 4 lectures on quantum rather than a dedicated major. This in contrast to this complaint that we hear that, no, we do kind of need, you know, undergraduate and graduate level training programs in quantum because we want to hire these people because we need to build these machines.
Right. So there should be engineering classes, and I'm not an engineer, so I'm not a good person to speak of the long list of classes they should be taking. But for example, in superconducting, there's a lot of use of microwave engineering, right? That area will continue to be very important for for quantum control. The Q Control, which is based in Sydney, right? Well, Mike Birchuk's company, he hires a lot of people like that. There's a range of people, right? So I'm not saying we only need basic software engineers. I'm not saying we only need physicists. There's going to be a range of people. Now, what's also going to be true is, and I really want to emphasize, is that this will change over time, right? How many people do we need right now who do, low level linear algebra optimization for Intel chips? Right. And the answer is there are probably a few very good ones, right? And they're kind of buried down there, but we don't need 200,000 of them. But at this point, quantum needs certain types of people. And we can find some of them. And then over time, we may need somewhat fewer of those, but we'll need people higher up the stack. We'll need people who work on the use cases and so forth. So, like anything else, let's put it this way. If you're going to be a software engineer, so I'm speaking now to any students here, and if there are some classes about quantum computing available to you, I don't think it would be a terrible idea if you still have time, right, before you graduate to take a class or two, because I think somehow it will intersect your career at some point.
Well, I suppose that was the question I was going to ask, because I've been hearing it a lot from students, is that they don't want an academic career, but they've seen this quantum stuff sort of come up and it's something that really, really interests them. But their question is, look, is there going to be a significant industry in this? Or is this going to fizzle out? Or, if I spend 4 or 5 years studying this, am I, going to waste my time compared to if I was studying traditional software development?
No, I mean, I don't see there being any sign that it's going to fizzle out, right? I mean, what I talked about a little while ago about quantum volume, we have certain headlights into the technology we're working on, the research we have planned, that we believe we can continue to double this quantum volume, right? This whole system metric year over year. At the same time, when you look at what we are doing, both regarding the theory, but also the architecture of the chips themselves, we are laying the groundwork for error correction. If we, I presume we will, have full error correction at some point, what it means to code in quantum will be different from the so-called NISQ era. This noisy intermediate stage quantum error that we have right now. So that alone is different, right? So we need people for the next, 5 to 10 years of noisy quantum, and then the skills will be different once we have error correction, and as we fade it in as well. So if you don't like change, maybe quantum isn't what you want to be doing.
But I suppose, given your experience of what you guys have done with sort of your partner networks and getting all these sort of non-quantum corporates involved, do you feel that they understand sort of the timeline? They understand the story. They're with it with you guys. They're not, expecting a million qubit error-corrected machine in 3 years. They actually know what's going to happen with this, even, the most optimistic assumptions of hardware development.
Yeah, so the people in the network, we are very, very explicit about that. We spend a lot of time talking to them about expectations before they even join. I also want to say one other thing, which is I think IBM is notable among the quantum players in that we publish specifications, right? So we talked before, 15 quantum computers available on the cloud. you can go in there to the queue experience. You can look at the T1, the T2 times, right, for the various machines and things like this. There's a lot of quantum from other people about the actual machines, right, that's clouded in mystery. Like, here you have a quantum computer in a lab that only special people can access. That's not been our approach. So we have been really, really working hard to say, this is what we have. Here are the numbers, right? As opposed to just lots of promises and things like that. We try to bring people in. We do, let me say, endless and very good, I mean, you know, tours in your town of showing people the technology, bringing them through the labs, the cloud data centers with quantum and so forth. So we do that with the people in the Q network. We do that with industry analysts. We do that with reporters. We do that with professors and things like this. So as much as we can, you know, we are extremely honest about where we are now. And when we think we will be at certain points, but we don't know everything. You know, we can't predict exactly. So people talk about the so-called hype with quantum. Mm-hmm. I have very mixed feelings about this word hype. I do feel that some people feel that any marketing is hype. I don't accept that. I think awareness and education is not hype, right? Hype is when you make outlandish predictions based on no data whatsoever. When you devise new laws about quantum based on no data whatsoever. So we're trying to make this as data-based as possible so that people see what we're doing and how we're doing it, right? We'd show you our chips. We let you use the chips. We explain why they do this, why do they do that. And then we, you know, there's not much more we can do. So so we try to be careful, but boy, are we passionate, right?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, there is so much, there's so much more to do, and there's so much work that, whether it's the experimental side, the theoretical side, the algorithm side, it's going to be a long slog, that's for sure.
It's the rest of the century and beyond, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, as you pointed out, you've got more of the rest of the century than I do. but you know, it's going to be fascinating decade by decade what happens here, right? You know, I mentioned, you know, we're passionate because it is such a fascinating field. Depending on, you know, let me say it this way. If you're involved with technology, there is something in quantum for you, right? Something that might interest you, even if you're only just learning more about it, right? And to satisfy yourself. And that's, you know, just if I may circle back to the book a little bit, you know, that was the approach. I wanted to make people feel that in a relaxed way, we would work through so that you could get a good understanding that even if you weren't going to be that quantum engineer or that researcher or whatever, that you could reason well enough about what was real and what wasn't. So that's how I tried to write it and position it.
Wonderful. So, I mean, we're coming up close to the hour now. And so just one more thing before I sort of let you go is there anything else you want to plug? Is there any sort of spoilers you can give us? any exclusive we can talk about on the podcast with relation to IBM's upcoming announcements? You know, is the 100-qubit machine going to show up on the network in the next 2 months?
Well, you know, we're recording this on January 27th, New York time, January 28th, Sydney time. There was the large CES conference in Las Vegas about 3 weeks ago. We announced a lot of things there. So we're in this little lull, shall I say, right now about it.
I would like to think that I'm better than CES, but maybe I won't get that big on my shoulders.
Let me just say kind of, you know, my perceptions of that, which is this. In many ways, this is moving faster than I think people expected. regarding, you know, having actual quantum computers out there on the cloud. That was our announcement about quantum volume. We also did an announcement about Daimler and lithium batteries, you know, research that's going on there. Conveniently, lithium is a very small atom. and so it will be more amenable to research and use with quantums, with smaller quantum computers based on today's, the variational methods that people do right now. So it is one of these fields that I think it's beginning to accelerate now. And so for me, there are two things I want to talk about this year with folks beyond my book, you know, Dancing with Qubits, just to plug that one more time for this year. So the first is, and we spoke a little bit about this, but exactly how is it that these quantum computers are going to be working with classical computers? You know, what is the breadth of this thing we're calling quantum computing, right? Don't call it hybrid, right? It is just the way it works. And understand that that's the way it works. So by the end of this year, I hope we all have a much better idea about how this new blended world will be working and as it relates to real use cases and the research that has to be done to make that possible. The second thing is that we talked a lot about education. We talked a bit about different types of software engineers and people involved now. I think 2020 is the year when we start getting what I'll call enterprise developers interested in this. Now, what is an enterprise developer? Well, look, it could be somebody who does Java. It could be somebody who uses DB2 or WebSphere or SAP or something like this. They are not going to be getting any sort of quantum advantage this year with that. But we're past what I'll call the early adopter phase of people who hear about it and want to learn more. So for all of us, we have to continue with the education of the core people. And you did a very good job of saying, you know, the different jobs that students would have and who would be hiring them and when. Mm-hmm. But I think we open up even a little wider now. And we start talking about really how quantum over time, right, will start to affect those other types of developers and what they do and how they will access it and what they need to know. So everything in the right time, but I think now we're moving into that, the early part of that phase.
Well, from your lips to God's ears.
Hey.
Anyway, so yes, we'll certainly link to the Amazon page for your book and to the PAC publishing website and anything else, and certainly we'll direct anyone who happens to ask questions about your new tome on quantum computing your way, and hopefully you'll get some more feedback, and hopefully you'll bring up a whole new group of people who are interested in quantum computing.
I hope so.
Great. So, Robert, thanks again for giving me an hour of your time.
Very good, Simon. Wonderful to talk to you. Take care.
Great. So thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode. As normal, I can't predict when the next one's going to come out, but stay tuned to our social media feeds for the next upload. So thanks a lot.